It's the Goodbye Aaron edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, lead violence, Calgary flu controversy, eulogy to Aaron Swartz, and Sam Harris shoots himself in the foot again. Let's begin episode 196.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stars. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, we've got a great economic opportunity here to make some money. I don't know if you were listening to the news today, but apparently the BC Supreme Court has struck down human trafficking laws. Woohoo! So we can now, like, import people and make money off of that sort of thing.
Wouldn't that break other rules?
Well, no, apparently it's one of those, it's the law as it is stated basically says anyone who brings anyone into the country for whatever reason is committing human trafficking, which in some ways, if it deals with, you know, sex slaves or anything like that, obviously, yes, we want to stop that. But this revolves around the case of a bunch of Tamils who were famously arrived off our shore a little while ago. And a lot of that was seen more as political refugees, which there was no distinction in the law between sort of what you would consider to be genuine good human transportation versus the bad slavery human trafficking of the old ways. But so anyone out there, because there's going to be a period of time now where there is no law applicable to human trafficking. So good if you want to get in those, you know, genuine refugees. But if you just want to make a buck or two, opportunity's knocking.
Great. Fantastic.
Speaking of opportunity knocking, it seems like the whole world has taken a one step further to be in a peaceful world. Well, in a way, we've kind of talked, you know, a bit about gun violence recently. We've talked about Sam Pinker's, how the world is becoming sort of a more and more peaceful place. And a lot of that is sort of in contrast with sometimes what we see as a much more violent world out there. But the actual numbers of violence seem to be keep coming down. And you go, well, how can, you know, this is like strange paradox at work. Well, apparently recent research has finally figured out that what's actually happening, it's all to do with lead. Apparently, it's not that guns that kill people. It's not people that kill people. It's lead that kills people. And no, not the lead in the bullets. Don't look at me like that. Apparently, recent research is done has showed that against all sort of expectations, it's the rise and fall of lead-based paints and leaded gasoline that seems to have a link to actual gun violence or violence in general. Studies between cities, states, and nations shows that the rise and fall of crime rates follow roughly a 20-year lag with the exposure of infants to traces of quantities of lead. Lead was withdrawn from paint and then later from gas, but at different times around the world, beginning roughly in the 1970s in the UN, in the case of gasoline, and in 1990s in most of Europe. Yet, the patterns of violence remained the same, although, you know, like so there's the same sort of pattern occurred. Violence crimes peaked around 20 years after the lead pollution was removed, and then it steadily declined. In the USA studies, it even showed that during the lead period, larger American cities seemed to have a lot more violence. But in the sort of post-lead era, they all went down to a particular mean, sort of a similar number.
Hmm.
I'm not quite sure how that works. I guess more lead in inner cities because of ghettos and that sort of thing. So there was more lead exposures in bigger cities than maybe in smaller cities. And so there was a greater reduction in the larger cities than the smaller cities. Now, of course, there's attempts that you have to rule out correlation versus causation. So there are many other confounding factors such as social economic status, income, education, and all these were tested and compared to lead, and lead still maintained this relationship. Now, as people may or may not know, lead poisoning is a major neurotoxin. lead interferes with synapse formation in the cerebral cortex, neurochemical development, organization of ion channels, and causes the loss of what they call mural sheath. It's a sort of a fatty coating that's on all your nerve cells, which has been found to be more and more involved in the actual functioning of the brain, just not sort of a supporting structure. The reduce in the number of neurons, interferes with neurotransmitters, yada, yada, yada. All this leads to an impairment of the brain. So it's reduction of intelligence, memory, motor skills, and emotional control, i.e. violence. Now, that all being said, one study published in 1986 found that 18% of white children and 52% of black children in the U.S. had over 20 milligrams per deciliter of lead in their blood, which leads to an interesting question. Now, there is an obvious and overwhelming inequality with regards to incarceration rates between the majority white population and the non-white population, African Americans in the U.S., natives here in Canada. The predominant explanation, at least by most of the progressive-minded people, is that it's systematic and institutional racism. This line of research implies that maybe there are some confounding factors, that it may not be all due to inequality, but to biochemical. And I was sitting there and I was trying to place this in sort of the pantheon of social justice. How does this play into it? Because if there is actually a chemical, sort of an environmental factor here that is not cultural based, that is causing this, is this good research or is it bad research? Or is this just sort of someone trying to make an excuse as to, oh, no, it's not us, it's the paint.
Yeah, well, it's an intriguing hypothesis. I'm a little skeptical. I mean, lead has been used by various civilizations throughout time. I don't know if we would consider that there was a lot of peace after the Roman Empire collapsed. I don't think we can make that case.
Well, no, to be fair, incidents of gladiatorial violence did reduce significantly after the fall of the Roman Empire.
There may be other reasons for that decrease. I mean, it is intriguing. I mean, for example, I could see that if you had a lot of shelters for, at-risk youth, and a lot of the funding for those is fairly low, so maybe they resorted to cheaper paint to paint the halls of the rooms. Who knows? I mean, there could be lots of ways that they could be exposed to lead, and certainly, there could be a lot of effects that would have on if a whole generation of people were exposed to it. But, I don't know. We have to sort of, I'd like to see more studies on this before I put too much faith in the lead hypothesis.
Well, to be fair, the article that I was researching was actually making reference to, I think, over a dozen other research papers, which in themselves made reference to over 301 other articles. And they made a big point of saying, of those ones, only one was sort of against this hypothesis. And that one was actually published by the lead industry. So
big lead.
It led to a bit of a controversy,
right,
about that. But it also goes into with the one of the theses of, I think, Freakonomics when it was released, is that it sort of said, well, one of the big reasons for the sort of overall reduction of violence was the idea of abortion. And that because there were sort of less unwanted children and less people sort of forced into poverty because of unwanted birth, that this also accounted for the reduction. And I think, I don't think I would rule out any one of these things, but I think it does go with the idea, and we might do this in a future show, is this sort of annoying sense of progress for humanity. I mean, as much as I don't think the world is necessarily perfect or anything, but it's hard to say that any one period of time was worse than any previous period of time. I mean, there are bad things about it, right? So, I mean, you had slavery, and before that there was left. But it seems like no matter how much humans try to shoot themselves in the foot at any particular moment in time, the progress in general seems to be to a more harmonious society by and large. Although, granted, now that we have biochemical and nuclear weapons, we can all snuff it like we could never have done before. But, I mean, like I say, Pinker's book, I mean, there is empirically, this world is a much better place to live in now than it has ever been in the history of humanity.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you were to look at a graph zoomed out, it's an upwards arc of getting better. But if you zoomed in, it's like it's zigzagging up and down.
Exactly. I mean, like someone who's living in Niger right now. It probably has a hell of a lot worse life than they had in almost any European city of moderate wealth for the last 500 years. So, yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, there is that sort of annoying continuous trend. I mean, I think the aliens will never come to save us.
No, they won't. They don't like us. But speaking of something completely different, now, Don, do you recall a couple of years ago, there was that H1N1 thing?
That H1N1 that deals with these. The chess game where Sakharov moved his. No, you're referring to the flu.
I am referring to the flu. So this is a bit of news that harkens back to the H1N1 days. In 2009, when the vaccine was in scarce supply, news hit that the Calgary Flames hockey team and their families had received the shot in a private clinic, essentially skipping the queue. So what exactly happened? Recently, there's been an Alberta healthcare inquiry trying to figure this out, and it's kind of interesting. According to two nurses, Nurse Michelle Bosch and Nurse Debbie Hyman, they were contacted by the team doctor Jim Thorne, and the nurses said that they suggested going to a private clinic because having the Flames come stand in line with the rest of the people would inflame, no pun intended, an already volatile situation. There were already long lines at the clinics full of irritated people, so they said, okay, well, let's do a private clinic type thing. To quote the article, Ms. Hyman said they left a voice message with their direct supervisor asking for a callback if a private vaccination for the team was not allowed. 3 days later, after hearing nothing back from her boss, they took 200 doses over to Mr. Thorne's clinic and administered the vaccine. Now, while they were giving the vaccine, the team doctor was coaching the players to say that they got the vaccine at Brentwood and not at a private clinic. The nurses thought this was kind of confusing. They testified that the paperwork filled out by the Flames vaccination indicated the shots were given out at Brentwood rather than at the office. So again, it was kind of odd because from their point of view, they weren't doing anything wrong, but they were being coached to say, we got this vaccine at a public clinic, and the documentation was written to say it was gotten at a public clinic and not at a private office.
That strikes me as innately as I must be doing something wrong. Why are they doctoring the record?
Well, that's what Health Vice President Laurie Anderson was asking, who investigated the incident. She claims that they lied about the vaccine because they, quote, they didn't want it known that they had a private clinic for the Flames. She also goes on to say that she doubts that having the Flames in line for a vaccine would have caused any trouble. According to the rules, the vaccine was only to be distributed at 4 locations. Other groups, including seniors, were denied getting the shots at private locations. So it makes sense that if you're not going to give it to, say, seniors, you really don't have a reason to give it to hockey players. Now, neither nurse can explain how 200 doses ended up at the office and how the families of the players got brought into the deal. There's only about 30 or so players, plus maybe the training staff. I mean, you're looking at less than 50 people. So how 200 doses found their way there is confusing. Now, there was really no rule at this point that, you know, there was a priority list. However, the next day, there was. Ah. So risky timing comes into play here.
High risk.
High risk, yes. So once news spread that there was the Flames sort of jumping the queue, there was outrage. And Nurse Hyman and her supervisor were both fired. And now we have this public inquiry. So what's to be made of all this? You know, on the one hand, they didn't necessarily break any rules at the time, except for giving the vaccine at the doctor's office. The next day, of course, if they had done this, they would have been breaking the rules. Would having a team of hockey players show up at a public clinic cause trouble? Personally, I would say no.
I think it would have been a great PR thing.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think that there would have been, people would want to come and take their pictures with them and they would have gotten autographs, but I don't think it would have been pandemonium. So I don't buy that. And I don't know, just the fact that they're skipping ahead, they're getting preferential treatment, is just not good optics.
No, well, and I think this leads into some more interesting questions. I mean, we've often talked on the show, and it's a meme in Canadian society, the whole idea about two-tier medicine, right? And that although we have publicly paid healthcare, it is delivered by private firms. And I would be curious to know whether this private doctor and or anyone else associated with this receive some form of remuneration for this jumping the queue, to sort of speak about it.
Well, he was the team doctor. So he was employed by the Calgary Flames.
Right. What about the nurse and the other guy who got fired?
Yeah.
They were sort of innocent bystanders to all this.
Right? Yeah. But, I mean, they're the ones who procured the vaccination. So, I mean, there could have been some kind of, you know, help us out with this, you know, you'll get something in return type thing. Who knows, right?
Exactly. Or maybe in an innocent way, you know, ooh, it's the Calgary. But, I mean, you're more into the sports than I am. I mean, are the Calgary Flames really that big that you had to worry about this? I mean, this is not like the 1980-something Wayne Gretzky team when they were like superstars in themselves. I mean, they are the local hockey team and everyone loves them. But, I mean, they're not like superstars, right?
Well, I mean, in a Canadian city, hockey players are pretty famous. I mean, that's just sort of the way it's hardwired. That being said, like I said, like if they were superstars, it's not like, you know, Tom Cruise is going to show up and people are going to go crazy, try to get his autograph. They're hockey players who are known for being relatively humble people who will, you know, pose with fans for pictures. You know, it's not, if you live in a Canadian city, you're going to see hockey players out and about. I've seen hockey players out and about and I don't freak out. So, I mean, the idea that they're going to be like a riot. Right. It's just not going
to
happen.
Well, and again, you think from a public health point of view, having celebrities come out to do something that you think everyone should be doing anyhow,
yeah,
would be a good thing to do. And you mentioned, too, the timing of when they made a priority list strikes as suspicious, as in either A, somebody knew that this was coming down the pike and they wanted to sneak it in beforehand, or B, it was like, oh, shit, this happened and we need to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. The timing does not leave a lot of, it begs the question that something might have been going on there.
Definitely not a hat trick for the team.
No. Well, let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a nonprofit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Duh. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So this past week, we lost one of the truly important people to skepticism, Aaron Swartz. Now, many of our skeptic audience may or may not know the name. Many may not think of him as a skeptic warrior. However, I believe he was. Aaron started his public life in helping to define the RSS standard. This is the news feed protocol that gives you your rolling list of what's happening on Facebook, the CBC News app, and of course, how you get the latest edition of Radio Free Thinker on iTunes. Aaron was involved in another project that turned out to be one of those internet gold mines, Reddit. Now, he kind of fell into this good fortune. He spent most of his effort to make information accessible to all, to free knowledge. He laid down the foundations for the Open Library Project. He was a major force behind the Creative Commons Project. But where he moved beyond the average progressive was his activism for freedom of the internet, freedom of knowledge. He started Demand Progress. Never heard of that? Remember last year when the internet went black? Wikipedia, WordPress, Craigslist, Tumblr, Twitter, and a lot of other sites shut down for the day? Well, that was Aaron at work, not as a terrorist, but as an organizer of the online community against legislation that threatened to shut down the internet as we know it. One of the most onerous provisions was a website could be shut down without notice or appeal if there was a link on that site, be it in the contents or the comments section, that linked to a site that was deemed to have quote-unquote illegal content. This would have made the ability for sites to act as a public forum impossible. He put his status, his money, and his efforts to start demand progress, which acted as a bulwark to this threat. He brought on board the other great internet giants, and more importantly, all the common people, and the bill died. Progress won. He had a strong sense that public information should be public. To this end, he first ran afoul of the law when in 2009, public access to court electronic records, or PACER, claimed documents were stolen. PACER is an electronic public access service in the United States for federal court documents. It allows users to obtain case and docket information for the United States district courts, appeal information, bankruptcy court things. PACER was charging 8 cents a page to access this quote-unquote public information. This struck many, including Aaron, as being wrong, and worse, a hindrance to a well-functioning democracy. Aaron took his money and his skills, and he did something. He used his money, over $1.5 million, and he purchased millions of documents from PACER, and then hosted them on another site called Recap, which actually allowed the public to access these documents for free. This, of course, annoyed the government greatly, and the FBI investigated, but they couldn't find where any laws were broken. After all, this was public information available to the public. However, Aaron had now set himself up as an enemy of the state. In late 2010, Aaron was feeling slightly frustrated as a non-student, quote, guest of MIT. He was a figurehead around the campus, but he was not technically a student, that he was not given access to JSTOR unless he paid for it. Now, many may or may not know that JSTOR is a preeminent warehouse of academic articles, journals, and published papers. It's a nonprofit, but they've created a paywall to limit access, largely to academic institutions like UBC et al. This struck Aaron as wrong because the vast majority of the works published were funded by tax dollars. It should be available to everyone. And as skeptics, we know the importance of information and the availability, but in order to make sound decisions. In his effort to free knowledge, he slipped a laptop into an unlocked network closet, something that was not uncommon on the campus, and using a script, downloaded articles from JSTOR. Now, this particular connection he had did have legal access to the JSTOR library. He was not hacking into their computers in any sense that we think about it. This apparently, again, is something that's not uncommon. The only difference is that this time, Aaron downloaded 4 million articles or so. Now, it seems that Aaron did have, like I say, legal access to computers that had JSTOR, but the bulk of the original complaint was that he was downloading too many articles. To quote one report, as best as we can tell, he was being charged for allegedly downloading too many scholarly articles from the website. It is like checking out too many books from the library. When JSTOR admins and MIT realized the massive downloads, they blocked the PC Aaron was using to access the site. Aaron, being an internet genius, started a cat and mouse game where he would alter his PC online performance and resume downloading. Ultimately, the physical PC was discovered and removed. It's important to note that this was not a hacker operation or Aaron had no ill intent. The PC he used had no encryption software. There was no attempts to cover his tracks. Although annoyed at Aaron's tactics, no harm was really done. So JSTOR declined to press charges. Even MIT was reluctant to prosecute Aaron when Aaron agreed to return the articles and not publish any of them online, as was his apparent original idea. However, part of his original idea too, I should note out, he was not intending to make any money off this. He was going to, again, just publish articles so people would have access to the knowledge. However, now is when things really get ugly and where we as progressive skeptics may take a note. Aaron had allegedly angered the government with the PACER incident. Thwarted federal legislation for SOPA and PIPA. Those are the things that are attempted to shut down the internet I mentioned earlier. And keeping the internet free, there's a free movement. So given the opportunity, the prosecutor literally threw the book at him, or so to speak. He was charged with wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawful attainment of information, and recklessly damaging protected computer. Most of which is not really true, but it depends on how you interpret the strictness of the law. He was to be fined millions of dollars, and prosecutors were pushing for at least 35 years in jail. I want you to take note, 35 years in jail is more than you get for like manslaughter, more than you get for bank robbery, so they were really pushing the limits on this. Attempts to plea bargain were stonewalled, and it looked like at best Aaron was heading for, like I say, a multi-million dollar legal battle with the federal government. Rumors, and yes, they are only rumors, purport to... point out that the federal government was also at this point trying to get someone in the hacker community to testify against Bradley Manning. And Bradley Manning, of course, is quite famous for the WikiLeaks documents about American activities in Afghanistan. It seems, of course, Aaron had other issues, and don't we all? We've talked previously about the subject of bullying leading to suicide. I can't see little difference here. What can you do when the state becomes the bully? To our audience, when an opportunity for you to bring to light something you think is of national interest, the public good, but might run you afoul of our political leaders, are you going to think twice? Do you want to go through what someone like Aaron went through? That's how they win. Aaron is dead. And with him, a dynamic force for internet freedom and access to knowledge. We currently have our own progressive movement, the Idle No More. Although focused on a very different topic, it shares one aspect. At what point do you say that the government of the state is not the government of the people? There is no happy ending. There's no inspirational speech. No light at the end of the tunnel. It's not like fiction. It's neither neat nor tidy. It's what it is. But now I have to ask, what are you going to do about it? We're going to end with a outtake of Aaron himself.
Has this big long list of names supporting the bill, and then just a few lonely people opposing it. And then on the other side, it says January 15th, and now it's totally reversed. Everyone is opposing it, just a few lonely names still hanging on in support. I mean, this really was unprecedented. Don't take my word for it, but ask former Senator Chris Dodd, now the chief lobbyist for Hollywood. He admitted, after he lost, that he had masterminded the whole evil plan. And he told the New York Times he'd never seen anything like it during his many years in Congress. And everyone I've spoken to agrees. The people rose up and they caused a sea change in Washington. Not the press, which refused to cover the story. Just coincidentally, their parent companies all happened to be lobbying for the bill. Not the politicians, who were pretty much unanimously in favor of it. And not the companies who had all but given up trying to stop it and decided it was inevitable. It was really stopped by the people themselves. They killed the bill dead. So dead that when members of Congress propose something now that even touches the internet, they have to give a long speech beforehand about how it is definitely not like SOPA. So dead that when you ask congressional staffers about it, they groan and shake their heads like it's all a bad dream they're trying really hard to forget. So dead that it's kind of hard to believe this story. Hard to remember how close it all came to actually passing. Hard to remember how this could have gone any other way. But it wasn't a dream or a nightmare. It was all very real. And it will happen again. Sure, it will have yet another name, and maybe a different excuse, and probably do its damage in a different way. But make no mistake, the enemies of the freedom to connect have not disappeared. The fire in those politicians' eyes hasn't been put out. There are a lot of people, a lot of powerful people, who want to clamp down on the internet. And to be honest, there aren't a whole lot who have a vested interest in protecting it from all of that. Even some of the biggest companies, some of the biggest internet companies, to put it frankly, would benefit from a world in which their little competitors could get censored. We can't let that happen. Now, I've told this as a personal story, partly because I think big stories like this one are just more interesting at human scale. The director, J.D. Walsh, says good stories should be like the poster for Transformers. There's a huge evil robot on the left side of the poster, and a huge big army on the right side of the poster. And then in the middle, at the bottom, there's just a small family trapped in the middle. Big stories need human stakes. But mostly it's a personal story because I didn't have time to research any other part of it. But that's kind of the point. We won this fight because everyone made themselves the hero of their own story. Everyone took it as their job to save this crucial freedom. They threw themselves into it. They did whatever they could think of to do. They didn't stop to ask anyone for permission. You remember how Hacker News readers spontaneously organized this boycott of GoDaddy over their support of SOPA? Nobody told them they could do that. A few people even thought it was a bad idea. It didn't matter. The senators were right. The internet really is out of control. But if we forget that, if we let Hollywood rewrite the story so it was just big company Google who stopped the bill, if we let them persuade us we didn't actually make a difference, if we start seeing it as someone else's responsibility to do this work, and it's our job just to go home and pop some popcorn and curl up on the couch to watch Transformers, well then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, of course. So we talked about gun control and gun culture on the show before the holidays, which coincidentally has been lost to the ether of the internet. So we do apologize for that.
Gun conspiracy.
But we'll recover a bit of that right now because we're going to be talking a bit about, something stupid that Sam Harris said.
Again?
Again.
Did you say something? Ugh.
Well, you know, I feel bad for Sam. But anyway, you know, given the, really present cycle of gun-related news stories, Sam Harris started to weigh in on the issue of gun control. And his initial essay, you know, brought out obviously a lot of criticism from not just gun control advocates, but also the free thought community. So he defended his article in a follow-up article, and we're going to talk a bit about some of his points, some of the criticisms, and some of the follow-up from all this. So his first article basically suggests that we need stricter laws on gun licenses. And given that there are already massive amounts of dangerous weapons out there, it really doesn't make a lot of sense to try to sort of stuff that genie back into the bottle. That's a fairly reasonable point. I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to go out there and confiscate, you know, 30 million assault rifles, especially from people who don't necessarily want to give up their assault rifles. And having gun licenses that are a little bit harder to get and a bit more regulated will help with future gun-related problems. But of course, you know, We do have this problem of the genie out there. That's these hundreds of thousands of guns that are in the hands of potentially crazy people.
But we discussed this again, and we're going to do a bit of recapping during the show because some of our listeners listen online, so they didn't get the original show when we talked about this. But I mean, there's two aspects to this. I mean, one, a lot of the people who are what I'm going to call for the gun lobby suggest that the American government is going to go out and they're going to take everyone's guns. And no one is suggesting that they're going to take everyone's guns. The only people who are thinking that are the people who have the guns and they're up in their little metal shelter somewhere in Montana. And the other aspect of it is I mean, the idea of voluntary retraction. I mean, Australia, who had a horrible incident of mass shooting in 1993, I believe, in on Tasmania, Port Arthur. That's Port Arthur. One of the places there. Within 12 days, they had passed a massive gun law that restricted and reduced the availability of guns. And part of that, because again, there are guns out there, they said they had a massive buyback. And the American psyche is so crazy about this, is in Tucson, Arizona, where Kathy Giverds, who was shot, last year before that, by a crazy guy who tried to kill her, killed several other people in a shopping mall parking lot. She and her organization that she's founded were trying to buy back guns. And the local NRA, along with some politicians, actually have gone to court to say, no, you cannot do this. That not only does the Second Amendment protect one's rights to guns, but guns' right to live. That if they do buy these guns back, they have to be given or sold to other people. You cannot destroy the guns, which is just, it's a circular thinking that is insane.
Right. And we'll get into that aspect of this as well. Harris, he defends his position by saying that his own ownership of guns is okay because he's responsible with his guns. He goes to shooting practice where he gets expert training and how he, you know, is very responsible with his gun use. And okay, sure. So in a perfect world, responsible use of guns would be sufficient. Just like you could have responsible use of nuclear weapons or weaponized anthrax. But if those examples seem silly, you know, ask yourself why. Can there be responsible use of a nuclear bomb? When does a responsible individual need to shoot somebody? See, I think that you can't really have an answer to that question beyond, you know, scenarios involving police or military or those type of examples. For the average citizen, I don't think if you're being responsible, you need to have weapons. But anyway, P.Z. Myers responded to what Harris wrote. I'm going to quote P.Z. directly here. What I see over and over again in Harris and rabid defenders of gun ownership is something other than just merely seeing guns as a tool. It's the cult of the rugged individual, the lone cowboy on his own hostile territory, where the only recourse is to be quick on the draw. What's the answer to any trouble? Why, you take care of it yourself, usually killing the troublemaker. It's a simple, quick solution that doesn't require any thinking at all. So this kind of Clint Eastwood mentality of shoot first, ask questions later. So if someone breaks into Sam Harris's house with a gun, intending to do him harm, Harris, of course, thinks he's going to reach over, pull out his handgun, and blow the guy's head off. So to quote P.Z. Myers again, he has already lost, referring to this mythical home invasion. No matter how well-trained he is with a firearm, he is having a gunfight in his home with his family around him. Imagine yourself in your bedroom, pulling a pistol out of the bedside, loading it and calmly taking a few shots in the direction of the hallway without the presence of an intruder to complicate and make even more dangerous the situation. This is not an action without consequences and without risk. This is the preferred nightmare of the gun fanatics. So, getting to this idea of taking justice into your own hands, this is not a good idea.
Well, you know, and again, recapping some things before, the fallacy in this has been proven time and time again. I mean, again, with the guy that did the Newtown massacre, right? His mom was a gun owner, and she was the first one dead. Owning a gun is not going to save your life from someone who wants to shoot you. I mean, it's been proven time and time again. In fact, I saw, and I'm going to say it's a funny joke, although perhaps not in the context, where they said, well, you just need to have armed guards at schools to protect people. And the picture had JFK in Dallas. And little arrows pointing to gun. And a little caption below, guns don't save you from gun violence.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing too is, like Harris was talking about how 911 is too slow. Well, yes, if someone breaks into your house with a gun, 911 might be too slow. But having a gun is not going to rectify the situation, because what if somebody has a sniper rifle and they're aiming at you from across the street? What if somebody is about to drop a 13-ton megaton nuclear bomb on your house? You know, you have to accept a certain amount of risk. And it's funny because Harris wrote an essay maybe a year or two ago about fighting and personal defense. And he was basically advocating that if you're about to fight somebody who is, you know, out looking for a fight, you are by definition not prepared to fight this person. Because you weren't looking for a fight, this person was. So that should tell you right there that you're probably not going to win this fight. And your best thing is to run away. And I'm wondering, why doesn't Harris think that if somebody breaks into my house with a gun, I shouldn't run away and call 911?
No, well, and again, this goes with the idea that, I mean, we talk about sort of the worship of gun violence in the United States, and to a certain degree, they have, as you put it, the rugged Western sort of mountain man sort of idea. But we've talked again on previous shows, and it's another meme, is in the United States, they have the stand your ground laws, where the whole mentality has changed from, you know, instead of trying to defend yourself, shoot first, ask questions later. And this seems to be what Sam Harris is almost advocating away. I mean, he said someone's broken into my house, and he's immediately assumed this person is going to kill me. I have to kill him first. Not that he wants to steal my $20 out of my wallet, and then he's going to run away. Which, I mean, okay, I'm out some money, but no lives have been taken. But it's no, instantly kill first, then ask questions later. And this sort of mentality is permeated into the United States psyche, which I think is another reason why this is... It's crazy.
Yeah. So the thing that gun advocates come back to often is the Second Amendment, the part of the Constitution that allows ordinary citizens to keep guns. And it's in place to protect tyranny from the state. You know, the idea is that if you have an armed militia, you're not going to have the type of situation where, you know, the king sends in his royal forces to subject the population.
Well, and I think, too, now I must admit I haven't memorized the American Constitution, nor should I have. But this is also a time when the United States did not have a standing army, right? I mean, they called one up for the revolution, but then they disbanded. So the idea of a militia in a country that does not have a standing army is there is France and there's Germany and there's evil Canada waiting to invade the country. You want to make sure that you have a national defense ready in lieu of a standing army. So, I mean, again, it's not even to protect yourself necessarily from the tyranny of this state. It's to protect the state in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw an interesting post by Michael Shermer on this point. He was talking about this culture of we need to protect ourselves from the government, which is interesting because can you really expect handguns and rifles or even assault rifles to be of any use against tanks and bombs and jets? If the American military wanted to kill you, they're probably going to kill you, and you're not going to make a difference with handguns. So, you know, the Second Amendment in this respect is so meaningless. It's an artifact in today's society.
Well, and we were talking a bit before the show, and I think there's a certain uniqueness to the United States. I mean, you know, we talk about violence in movies, violence in games. Well, it's not like, you know, people in Korea don't play violent video games. It's not like people in Canada don't watch the same kind of violent movies. But in the United States right now, you may or may not be aware, are involved in a few wars around the world. I mean, they still have military presence in Iraq. There's Afghanistan going on. And the American people look at the news and they see on there how you've got this sort of ragtag band of people holding off the mighty American army with just a few guns and their wits and that sort of thing. And although, you know, the Taliban is evil, they get in their minds that it is possible for a small group of people with just simple guns to defeat the American army. Well, missing the whole point that the American Army presence in Afghanistan is a pittance compared to what they have. It's a pittance to what they have in Iraq. If there was an armed insurrection in the United States, you are talking about millions of troops and everything the American government has, it's its military in its hands to defeat this, and a bunch of lone nuts in Montana aren't going to last 30 seconds with that.
Yeah, exactly. So Harris, of course, decided to write a follow-up article to his initial one. And I saw an interesting quote that I want to pull out here. He writes, "If I saw a way that we could remove 300 million guns from our streets, perhaps by amending the U.S. Constitution, instituting a $150 billion buyback program, then I would be happy to weigh the merits of doing this. But given the legal and political realities of the U.S., I don't consider the banning and confiscation of guns to be a serious possibility, nor does it seem to be a goal of gun control advocates." So, back to me again. So what? We should arm everybody? Like, this is not a good reason to not try to disarm a population of people. And he seems to be drawing this really arbitrary line in the sand, like, we can't solve this problem, so let's not try.
And, you know, that's the big thing that drives you nuts in this whole thing.
Yeah.
And the same way you also get with, you know, you shouldn't ban any gun, because if you ban any gun, you are banning all guns. There's just like black and white. And we often talk about in the skeptic community about this false dichotomy, that it is not black or white. It is not, if you can't stop all the problem, you shouldn't even start trying to solve part of the problem. And again, this is where Sam Harris makes me so, so frustrated, is some of his ideas I kind of like, but recently he's proven to be such a bad skeptic because he falls into all these logical and linguistic traps that he should know better.
You know, and the funny thing is, like, he does make good points from time to time. Like, he says, you know, responsible use of guns. I can get behind responsible use of guns. If you are going to have a hunting rifle, you know, it makes sense that your license should require you to go through, you know, rigorous training and, you know, like repeated training so that every couple of years you have to go back and prove that you can still use this gun responsibly. But then he takes this and goes, so guns are okay then? Yeah, sure, why not? It's like, no, Sam, no, that's not how things work.
You know, and many times people have made the analogy to cars, right? They mm-hmm. say, well, you know, cars kill people, so should we ban all cars? And again, it's that false dichotomy, but let's roll with that. I mean, one, you're not allowed to have any car you want. I mean, any car you buy has actually been approved by the government. I mean, you got to get what they call street worthiness. So you can't have something out there that's going to explode on you. You're only allowed to drive in particular areas. You're not allowed to drive wherever the hell you want, not on the sidewalk, whatever. You have to be licensed to drive. And if you found to be defective in one way or another, that license is removed from you. So there are lots of restrictions on cars and driving that make cars safe to have in our, or safer to have in our environment. So why can't you do the same incremental bits to gun law? But again, the Americans just they don't see it.
Yeah, it's frustrating, and it's frustrating to see people in our community not getting that as well. But let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll come back with more after this.
The best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're running out of time. So let's go to our skeptical highlights.
I've got a few this week.
Okay.
The first one, I admit, I just like the way it sounded. I tried to do a bit of research to find out a bit more of the details of it. But when you hear its title, you'll know why I picked this one up. The Harper Monologues, The Politics of Hate and Fear. Rage, Resist, and Rebel details the predatory politics of Stephen Harper, the prime manipulator of Canada. okay, I suspect it's not pro-Harper or pro-conservative government.
Really? I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, it's a little subtle in that, but it could also be, to be fair, it might be total quack woo out there, because you get a lot of conspiracy people out there. But this is going on at the Rhizome Cafe on East Broadway, Vancouver, this Thursday, the 17th at 8 p.m. Tickets are $10 to $20, depending on what category you fall into. It could be quite interesting to show up and see, hey, what the hell is this all about?
Sure.
Langara is having another philosopher's jam, How We Create Life's Meaning. Quote, Sigmund Freud once said that if you question life's meaning, you're sick. But existential philosophers think that if you never question life's meaning, you're not only naive, you're inauthentic. Ooh, authentic. Hmm. In this session, Kurt Prisberg will examine the meaning of the meaning quadrangle and consider the step-by-step methods of how an individual can take the creation of life's meaning firmly into their own hands. Kurt Prisberg is an instructor at Langara College. It is being held, not surprisingly, at the faculty and staff dining lounge at Langara, Thursday, January 17th at 7 p.m. It's free, so you have to choose. Do I hate Harper? Do I want to learn about existentialism? Tough choice. There's another one, talk coming up. Albert Camus, The Absurd Man's Path. Robert Duran presents a lecture on Camus' thinking, its topicality, who is the absurd man, and what is his path that he's leading. For people who don't know, Camus is a French philosopher who promoted the philosophy of the absurd. Absurdism refers to the conflict between the human tendency to seek inherent value and meaning of life and the human inability to actually find any. So in this context, absurd doesn't mean logically impossible, but humanly impossible. That is also this Thursday at 7 p.m. at Alice Franz on Canby, free. Wow, I've set up such a choice for people out there. What can I do? But you only do one?
Okay, well, my skeptical highlight, well, first of all, is today, because today is my esteemed co-host's birthday. Happy Ooh, birthday, Dawn.
Thank you.
My second skeptical highlight is coming up on Saturday, January 19th. January 19th. At 1 p.m., it is Cafe Inquiry, Has Violence Declined? Which is very apt, considering the things we've been talking about on today's show. So, at this cafe, we're going to be discussing the thesis of Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And we'll be discussing not only the general outline of what he's saying and the evidence for and against, we're going to be discussing whether or not this thesis is accurate. So we'll evaluate the evidence and we'll discuss some of the critiques, some of the criticisms, and people who have been advancing his thesis. So we'll have links to, if you check out the Facebook page or the event calendar on CFI Canada's webpage, we have a number of links to Pinker's TED Talk, a few other presentations that he's given, including critiques as well in the New York Times and book reviews of his novel. So check it out. I think it's really going to be interesting, and I think we'll have a vigorous conversation about it.
Yes, I think it will, although I worry that, unlike Pinker's thesis, is that the violence in the room will increase as the talk and the discussion, because people get heated when they start debating topics, and violence may ensue, even if it's just verbal violence.
Oh, we're pretty good at handling those situations.
Ooh. Well, you got all the guns.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, no, we're experts at diffusing tense situations.
Ooh.
That's good. Yes, we are, because we're skeptics.
Ah.
Yes.
I doubt that, but sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, that's all for today's show. Again, reminding listeners, you know, go to RadioFreethinker.com. You can download our previous episode, because CITR's podcast servers were down for like 3 weeks or something. So our previous episode is available. You can get it. And, you know, subscribe to the podcast.
Yeah, and that's episode 195. That's where we had the really interesting discussion with Dr. Thomas Kerr about harm reduction and the insight, as well as a few other enlightening topics that have slipped my mind for the moment. But that's on our Listen Now page at radiofreethinker.com. So go in, check it out. It's also a link on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning fire.